My guest today is Dr. Philip Kaper. He received his BA, MS, and MD degrees at UCLA and trained in internal medicine on the Harvard Medical Unit at Boston City Hospital. He's also the founding board member of Maine All Care, the Maine chapter of Physicians for National Health Program. He's been an adjunct lecturer on health policy and management at Harvard School of Public Health, a research associate at Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and an associate in health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. We're going to be discussing aspects of the medical industrial complex, the pros and cons of Obamacare, mostly cons, and how healthcare needs to be a voting issue. Today's program is sponsored by the Little Clover. That's in Osaka, Nipponbashi, across from the Alps Love Hotel. Pop in, have a drink, and say hello to Paul or Steve, and tell them Ryan sent you. And now let's welcome Dr. Philip Kaper to the program.
Well, Dr. Kaper, thank you for giving us this time with a very important issue. We want to talk about the medical industrial complex. A lot of people are familiar with the military industrial complex, but medical bills are the number one reason for bankruptcy in the United States right now. And fortunately, at least where people are talking about it, we have the Affordable Care Act, which some people are calling Obamacare. But would you say the ACA is a step forward or sideways or backwards? Does it really address the issues?
Well, it depends upon how you look at it. It's a step forward in that it corrects some of the worst abuses of the commercial insurance industry in this country. And I actually have a lot of admiration for President Obama and Speaker Pelosi and even Michelle Obama, who were willing to take on this very toxic, politically toxic issue, even against the advice of their top advisors, because they thought it had to be done, it needed to be done, and they promised to do it, so they did it. Having said that, the law itself, I'm afraid, is badly flawed. It does not cover everybody, even under the best of circumstances. It will leave 25 to 30 million people in the United States uninsured. It does little to control costs, not nearly enough, in my opinion. It is very difficult for the law to generate much public support because it's so complicated and so confusing. Most people don't understand it. Even many experts don't understand it. And the way it's funded and the way its benefits are distributed are patently unfair. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason. It's almost by chance whether you're covered or not. So it does some good things, but it leaves a lot to be desired, and it's unnecessarily complicated.
What is the point of having all these bronze plans, silver plan, gold plan, etc.? I mean, shouldn't the fact that you're sick or hurt be the basis of why you are getting health care?
Well, that's what I believe. Yeah, but the American public has been spun to believe that having a lot of choice among insurance plans is a good thing. I think people should have choice among providers of health care if they want it. They should be able to choose their own doctor, and they should be able to choose which hospital they want to go to. But I don't think choice of health plans, that is health insurance companies, or the kind of coverage you get buys you anything at all. I think that the I've never heard of Medicare. You know, we have a single payer plan in this country. It's called Medicare, and it's for people over 65. I have never once heard a Medicare beneficiary complain because they didn't have a choice of insurance. They're
well,
very happy with
Medicare. There's no choice, too, because it's saying, here's your choices if you qualify based on where you live, how old you are, what you make, this and that. And they kind of put you in a box, basically just because they know certain different graphics they can squeeze more money out of than others.
Oh, absolutely. No, the whole business of choice of insurance plans. In fact, the existence of this complicated plan is for the sole purpose of preserving a role for the insurance companies. And it's very expensive to do all this slicing and dicing. Much of the problems that people are having with the federal website and many of the state websites stems from the innate complexity of the law itself. You know, I'm sure there are computer problems that I imagine they'll iron out sooner or later at great cost. But even after that is done, the law itself is very complicated because people, first of all, don't have the information they need to choose the best plan for them because they don't know what kind of medical care they're going to need in the coming year.
Right.
They don't know whether they're going to get cancer or diabetes or have a stroke or be run over by a truck or fall off their skateboard or bicycle or have a ski accident. You can't predict that. Therefore, you can't possibly pick the appropriate plan for yourself. So this whole business of choice, you know, Americans, it tests well in focus groups, but people don't really understand what it means in terms of medical care.
Now, is it the convolutedness and complexity of it, is that because, I know it's called Obamacare or it's nicknamed that, even the Obama administration has caved into that name, but it actually came from Congress who wrote the act, and the way Congress usually works is the lobbyists write them a law and they put their name on it. Do you think it's because of Congress that they've protected the insurance companies on this?
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. President Obama made a few mistakes in pushing this law forward. First of all, he let the Congress write the thing without sufficient guidance from the administration. And he did that because he was advised to do that in order to eliminate what happened to the Clintons when they tried to pass their plan, you know, a decade ago. And so he said, well, let Congress write it, and if they write it, they'll feel they own it, and they'll pass it.
It was two decades ago.
Right,
seems
exactly.
Like it, right?
Yeah, it seems. Time flies when you're having fun. But, yeah, it was two decades ago, 1993. So, you know, I think that that his mistake was in thinking that he was dealing with reasonable people. And, in fact, he wasn't. He was dealing with people that were determined to make him fail, and he was dealing with people who were determined not to have universal health care. So he really, I think, was a little snookered by the people in the Congress. And the Congress is a decent editor of legislation, but they're a terrible author of legislation because you're dealing with 535 people. All of them have somewhat different or sometimes dramatically different agendas, values, experiences, and objectives. And when you let the Congress write a law, it ends up resembling what I once heard a helicopter being, and that is a collection of spare parts flying in loose formation. There's very little coherence to it.
I hope it's not made by Bell. That's what you have with.
Well, when I worked on the Hill, we used to call it a Christmas tree because it's like a tree, and everybody puts their own ornaments on it. They're sort of hung at random, and they don't resemble one another, and it's just a mess. Well, that's what this law is. And that's where I think he really went wrong. He needed to have a stronger hand in guiding its design. And I think here's where his relative inexperience when he first became president, his relative inexperience with the Congress really hurt him. And I feel badly because I think his intent was very good. But what he should have done is push at least for the public option, or at least for incrementally lowering the eligibility age of Medicare. But he wasn't able to do that, and I don't think he pushed hard enough for it.
Yeah, I'd like to lower the age to like a month old or something.
I think zero would be the right number. I mean, I agree. I believe healthcare is a human right. And the proper way to finance a healthcare system is not through insurance. I think insurance is the wrong way to do it, because the business of insurance is slicing and dicing people into smaller and smaller risk pools so you can charge people different premiums. I think that's totally inappropriate for healthcare. Healthcare should be funded, as most countries in the world do it, through a tax system. And it should be a progressive tax system. So people who have more money pay more, and people who have less money pay less. That's the only way to get everybody into the same system. And the slice
insurance puts the market upside down. I mean, you're putting all the market forces against you.
Well, the insurance companies benefit from you being well, okay? So that they benefit if you're perfectly healthy. So they love to insure healthy people. That's their fundamental business. And sick people tend to be shuttered off into an extremely dysfunctional individual or small group market, or they're pushed off onto the public program because they're impoverished enough by their illness, they end up on Medicaid. And or Medicare, you know, insures the people most likely to be ill, and that's the elderly. So the business of the insurance companies is to try to collect as many premiums as they can, and then to resist paying anything out in claims if they can help it. So what they do is to try to avoid people who are sick or likely to become sick in the first place. Or if their subscribers do become sick, they try to dump them. This was a well-known process called rescission, where if you had private health insurance and you became ill, the insurance company could go back into your medical history, contact your doctors, find out if there was anything in your history that you didn't disclose, maybe a sprained ankle or acne when you were a teenager or whatever, and then claim you defrauded them by forgetting to mention that in your application, and dump you, and just saying, we're sorry, here's your money back, you're on your own, goodbye.
Well, that's one thing that supposedly was addressed by ACA.
Yes, that's right. The problem, though, Ryan, is that, yes, it was addressed, it was made illegal. There was a story on the news tonight about Johnson & Johnson paying some huge fine for illegally marketing drugs. These companies simply view these fines as being a cost of doing business. You know, they just pay them and then go back to doing what they're doing. You know, it's like getting a speeding ticket. You just pay the speeding ticket and then you go off and speed again. We didn't remove
the fines for pollution, too. They weigh the cost-benefit analysis and they say, well, I'll just continue to pollute and pay the fine because that costs less than not polluting.
Well, that's right. And that addresses an issue you brought up early in the interview, and that is the commercialization of medicine. What the ACA doesn't do, even though it tries to make some of these practices illegal, it doesn't remove the incentives for continuing to do them. So these companies are very smart, and their incentives are to make as much money as possible. And in order to do that, they'll bend the law or break the law. Unless somebody goes to jail, and you can't put a company in jail, that's the problem. So they pay their fines and they figure, well, we'll make more money by continuing to do this than we do by paying the fine. So we'll just go ahead and pay the fine and build it into our pricing structure and everything will be fine.
We have the same structure for the mandatory insurance too. People are forced to buy some sort of insurance, and yet the penalty for not doing it is less than they might have to pay. Even though they're getting subsidized, it's not till the end of the year, so you're basically being forced to give some insurance company an interest-free loan for a year, which you'll get subsidized at the same time your following year bill kicks in, so you're still paying the money. So a lot of people just are going to ignore it.
Well, we'll see if that happens or not. The insurance companies are hoping it doesn't because they need healthy subscribers in order to keep the insurance affordable. And the government needs young people to sign up for the same reason. Because if the young people don't sign up, the whole program is going to crash and burn because the insurance premiums will become higher and higher, eventually become unaffordable for more people, and the coverage will begin to shrink. So that's a key. I mean, I always thought that the individual mandate that is requiring people to buy a product which may seem very expensive to them, even with the federal subsidies, from a company they don't like very much, is something that is just not going to be sustainable. People just don't like insurance companies very much, and they're going to resent being forced to buy private insurance.
And they have to buy in their certain regions too. Like, you can't always cross state lines to buy insurance, and there's no real market forces on that either.
Well, that's right.
Corporate welfare.
See, that's why insurance is the wrong way to do this. If you want to have a universal plan, just make it clean and put it in the tax system. It can be payroll taxes, it can be income taxes, it can be sales taxes or value-added taxes. Put it in the tax system. It's much easier to enforce. It's much more accepted, even though nobody likes to pay taxes. We still pay taxes. We all pay taxes. And they would have avoided a lot of these problems. You know, when Medicare was implemented, I was a young physician when Medicare was implemented in 1966. They signed up 19 million people over 9 months, despite some fierce political opposition from the southern hospitals that were opposed to Medicare because they didn't like the fact that Medicare required them to desegregate their wards. But despite all that, and despite the absence of sophisticated computers at that time, Medicare enrolled almost 20 million people over a period of 9 months. The same thing could have happened here, because you don't have to ask people questions about their income, whether they're getting alimony, whether they're married or divorced, you know, all of this stuff. That all goes away. That's what's creating many of the problems with the exchanges, because there's so many different databases that have to be tapped into that it becomes very confusing. You have to do it every year. Your circumstances may change within the year that will allow you to change plans even within a year. So the whole thing is just unnecessarily complicated. You have to ask why does it have to be so complicated? And the only plausible reason is to preserve a role for the private insurance companies. Yeah, and they add no value.
Be their biggest department.
It is. And that, it is, absolutely.
I was kidding, but yeah.
Okay. No, it is. And any insurance company, underwriting is the biggest department. That all goes away in a single-payer plan, such as the one I'm advocating. Goes away.
Well, I want to get to the heart of the issue. Maybe you agree, maybe not. But I think the main problem with U.S. healthcare is the cost of procedures and drugs.
Right. Because
you can play around with, like, how does shifting the ratio of how much is paid out of pocket versus taxes or borrowed money address the issue of the total cost?
Well, that fragmentation of financing is in itself one of the major reasons we pay twice as much per capita as, on average, all the other wealthy countries pay for healthcare. It's because it's like a dike that's springing leaks all over the place, and you just can't stop them. You can't keep up with it, because every time you plug up one hole, another one opens. The latest hole that's opened in the United States has been more and more costs are being shifted to individuals. So what I call the medical industrial complex is almost at the point of wringing as much money out of employers as they can. There's too much pushback now. They've wrung as much money out of state government as they can, because Medicaid budgets are eating everything else alive. And they know they're going to have to find another source of revenue. So they're pushing more and more of the costs off on individuals. They're calling it consumer-directed healthcare. That means you pay more and more of the bill, and that's supposed to control costs. But if you read the Time magazine article last March by Stephen Brill, you understand that consumers have no power whatsoever to push back on the cost of care. You know, I don't know. Do you know that article? Have you seen that one?
Yeah, I actually sent him an email to interview after you. So.
Yeah. Okay. It's called Bitter Pill, and he does a brilliant job of journalism. He
like
documents.
Pages.
Well, yeah, it was 28,000 words in Time magazine, and it was and it sold out within 2 days, and he just basically exposed how confusing, arbitrary, and corrupt the system of pricing by corporate medical providers is, and he did a beautiful job of it. But when you get a bill for a hospital, first of all, it's incomprehensible because it's all in code. You know, code this is so much money, so code that so much. And people can't understand the codes. Even if they could understand what the codes meant, they would have no way of evaluating the appropriateness of the procedure. I mean, do you really need two disposable blood pressure cuffs in the same hospitalization, as I experienced recently? Well, my answer is no, you don't. In fact, you probably don't need any disposable blood pressure cuffs. But, and why do you pay $8 for a Tylenol that you could buy in the drugstore for 8 cents? So you have to go through and Brill went through these bills line by line. And I'm afraid to say it, but I think the system has become corrupt over the last 10 or 20 years because of the involvement of for-profit companies that are trying to do what they're supposed to do, and that's keep their stock price as high as possible. So I don't, in a sense, I don't blame the companies, but I do blame the public policy.
was a systematic thing there. I mean, the scare tactic here is they call Obamacare socialized medicine, but I don't see how paying for for-profit drug insurance companies who benefit from protectionist regulations can be conflated with socialism.
I'm it's not socialism.
Socialism either, but that's not what it is.
Well, it's not socialism because it's you know Medicare employs private doctors and hospitals. The vast majority of providers in this country are private. It is social insurance, and I would love to see the private health insurance company just dry up and go away. That would be the biggest service they could provide to the American people, aside from their shareholders, of course.
But why are the costs of procedures and drugs so high compared
Because they can be. We don't regulate them. Mm-hmm. Prescription drugs in this country are roughly double in price or more what they are in other countries. Other countries set the price, and they say to the pharmaceutical companies and the device manufacturers, here's what we're willing to pay you. And those companies still do business in all those countries. So they're still making money. They're just not making as much as they would like to.
Now, our government did the opposite. Like, I think it was in 2003, they actually made a regulation saying that Medicare can't negotiate with the big pharma.
That's right. Do you know who...
The regulations we have are the protectionist, the bad kind.
Well, that's right. I mean, and why do you think that is? Well, the reason you just have to follow the money. The floor leader in the House of Representatives for that bill is a congressman from Louisiana named Billy Tozan. And within 6 months after the bill was passed that prohibited Medicare from bargaining prices with drug companies, he became the head of Pharma, which is the largest lobbying company for drug companies in the country. And he was making $2 million a year. Now, that used to be called kickbacks and bribes. It now seems to be the way business is practiced in Washington.
Is this a typical revolving door?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. There was a story in the New York Times a couple of months ago about all of the Capitol Hill staffers who were involved in creating Obamacare, who have subsequently gone to work for insurance companies or drug manufacturers or somebody else on the provider side. So our system has become quite corrupt, and it's very, very worrying. There's too much money in it, and the money's coming from the wrong places. I mean, it's great for these corporations, but it's killing everybody else. That was Brill's point.
Literally.
Yeah, literally.
Or allowing them to die.
Yeah, 45,000 people in this country die from a lack of health insurance a year.
This is sad. You started on this already, but can you explain why just freeing up the market won't be enough to fix this? That compares to the war industries, because seldomly do the war industries sincerely seek peace. So those who profit aren't going to terribly be that interested in prevention or...
Well, I'll tell you why markets don't work, and then I'll tell you why we don't emphasize prevention. Markets don't work because the buyer has almost no information and therefore no power. The seller... That is, the drug companies, pharmaceutical companies, hospital corporations, they have all the information. So the sellers have no power. And there's an economist named George Akerlof, who is at the University of California, Berkeley, who wrote a paper in the 70s called Selling Lemons. And in that paper, he demonstrated that in markets where there's a huge asymmetry of information, that is, the sellers have much more information than the buyers do, those markets inevitably become corrupt. And he won a Nobel Prize in economics for that paper. And he's actually Janet Yellen's, the nominee to become the head of the Federal Reserve in the States. He's her husband. So that's...
I'm not a big fan of her.
Yeah, well, I mean that's the primary reason markets don't work in healthcare is because of the huge there's no free flow of information. Without information, you can't have a market that functions.
I think also you're kind of the consumer does lack information because they don't know what any of these machines are, what it ought to cost for an X-ray or whatever. But they're abdicating their purchasing power to a third party out of trust because there's a lack of transparency and the unfamiliarity with all the procedures, and also the confusing degree of demographic categories that the consumer can't really make a fair choice. Plus, it's not like buying a t-shirt or something. You can't really shop around when you're in the emergency room and say, oh, wait, I want to go to this other emergency room. And
see, yeah, that's right.
I mean, it's like, it's different. And
there's not really any free will in the sense that you make a dispassionate purchase. If you're buying a computer or a car or a washing machine or something, you can shop around. You can decide how much you want to pay and what features you want. You can make a trade-off. That's impossible in healthcare. So all this stuff about markets in healthcare is just so much blue smoke and mirrors. It's just a diversion. It doesn't work.
As a tiny fraction, maybe. I mean, you could allow people to shop across state lines for insurance. You could get rid of the regulations that are protecting drug companies and stuff. But that, all that, like tort reform, et cetera, it's a drop in the bucket, isn't it? I mean, that's...
Yeah, but even if you can shop across state lines for insurance and you're shopping for a cheaper policy, it's then not as good a policy. I mean, that's the trade-off. And you have no way of predicting what you're going to need during the period you're covered by that policy.
I know.
That's the problem.
Bring it up before someone else brings it up.
Yeah, well, I understand. Yeah, no, but, you know, that's this whole business about shopping for insurance is complete and total nonsense. Insurance is part of the problem. It's not the answer. It's not a question of having a more informed choice of insurance carriers. It can't be done.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter when as we've said, it's systematically backwards. But why can't the U.S. copy any of the working systems from the rest of the world?
Politics. Politics. The power of the medical industrial complex in Congress. They spent four times as much money lobbying as the military industrial complex does. That's all it is.
Four times as much as the military industrial complex.
Right. That's right. $1.5 million or $2 million a day is spent in Congress by this industry. So, you know, I mean, the United States is also the only country in the world that considers healthcare to be a business. You know, most other countries consider it to be a public good, like roads or other infrastructure, like public libraries or education or the judiciary or public safety. Mm-hmm. Those are public goods, and they're supported by and large by taxes in most countries, as well as in this country, although they're becoming increasingly privatized also.
I'm glad you brought that up about taxes, because there's an argument that, well, those other countries are drowning in taxes, but that's a myth, because the U.S. actually already pays more in taxes and still only provides health care for select categories like our millionaire congressman.
Well, actually, we don't pay as much in taxes as many other countries, even though we have a higher, what's called a nominal tax rate, because we have so many loopholes. You know, the Internal Revenue Code is just full of loopholes. Many corporations pay no taxes at all in this country.
And address is technically not in the country.
Well, they have these subsidiaries, the offshore subsidiaries. But the point is that you know, I write a column for the Bangor Daily News every month. And a couple of months ago, I wrote one that was called Canadians Pay for Their Healthcare in Taxes, and Now They're Wealthier Than Americans. And that got a lot of attention. You know, I've been writing for years about how they're healthier than Americans. Nobody seems to be too impressed with that. But when you say they're wealthier than Americans, then you get a lot of attention to it. And the reason they're wealthier, one of them is that they pay only about two-thirds as much for medical care as we do. And the medical care system, which is so firmly tied to employment in the United States, is really bad for the economy because it creates job lock. People don't have the job mobility they would if they weren't worried about losing their insurance. So it smothers entrepreneurship, because people have to find a job where they can get health insurance, which usually means a big corporation.
And it's hard on the businesses, too, for the businesses to have to pay out for all their employees' health care when that could have been done by the state or something. But really, if you fix the cost of the procedures, it really wouldn't matter who had to pay it. I mean, it's like in Japan, I had a torn hamstring in the United States, and ended up paying more than $600, and I had insurance. And I had the same injury in Japan, same leg. I re-injured it because I never had physical therapy in the U.S. It cost me $28.
Yeah,
and even if I'd paid 100% of it, it would still have been less in the United States. And it was the same procedure. Basically, you know, you get x-ray, slip and crutches, you know, not in some drugs, but it's the total cost. So what do you think? We talked about the lobby in Congress, you know, four times as much as the other MIC, but how about public apathy? How responsible is it for the public? Because it seems like with this being such a big issue, this ought to be a bigger issue than gay marriage or birth certificates. I mean,
well, but you know, what's happened in this country, and one of my previous columns was called "Where Is the Outrage?" Because our healthcare system is so broken. Everyone you talk to here has a horror story, either that they've experienced themselves or somebody they know has experienced. And where's the outrage? And I think one of the problems is that the way we pay for healthcare is so diffuse. There's so many different ways we pay for it. It's like the story of the frog in the pot of water that's slowly getting warmer and warmer. He doesn't notice it until it's too late. I think that's a good analogy for the healthcare system. We pay in taxes. We already pay more in taxes than most countries pay in total. So even though we have all these private insurance companies, we pay more in taxes for healthcare than other countries pay for their entire population. So that's one source. We have out-of-pocket payments. We have insurance premiums. We have depressed wages, because even the unions with good benefits have not taken a raise in years because they're just trying to keep up with the rise in healthcare costs, which routinely are two or three times the rate of inflation. So this is a system which is slowly squeezing money out of every other sector in order to thrive itself, which is another point that Stephen Brill points out.
Yeah, you call it an island economy. Like, while our economy, you and our economy, is in the toilet, healthcare economy is thriving on their side.
Right, right. And he points out that the health hospital administrators, who are now called CEOs, incidentally, are usually the highest paid employees in almost any community. You know, they make millions and millions of dollars. They don't make as much as people in publicly traded companies do, but they make many, many times more than they used to, even in a small and relatively poor state like Maine.
Well, a lot of them wear more than one hat also. But part of the public apathy, too, is when you watch the media, and if you just pay attention to the commercials, there's one ad after another for this pill or that pill over and over again. Can we really expect any honest reporting out of them?
Out of the media?
Isn't it ridiculous to advertise for a prescription drug, for example? I mean, should that be based on your symptoms?
Yeah, there are only two countries in the world that permit that. One is New Zealand and the other is the United States. And you're right, their marketing budgets far outstrip their research budgets, for example. And the fact that they're publicly traded and are so profit-driven has led to another interesting complication. Developing drugs that actually cure something, that is, just make it go away so it doesn't come back, whatever it is not a good business model. So that most companies are not investing in drugs that actually cure anybody. They want a drug that you're going to have to take one pill every day for the rest of your life. So statins are a good example of that. Beta blockers, you know.
Mental health stuff.
Mental health drugs, exactly. Antidepressant drugs. That's what they're investing in. But they literally don't want to invest in drugs that cure things because they can't get their money back.
A lot of these drugs, talking about psychotropics for a second, they complain about their R&D costs or whatever, but how different are some of these drugs from each other? Because it just seems like they put a new fancy name with rare letters in it. They like to have some Z's and X's and Y's or whatever, but it's the same pill as the one before it.
Yeah, that's right. And they get another 17 or 20 years of patent protection. So, you know, what I'm saying is the system is fundamentally broken. That's why incremental fixes like Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act are not going to work, because the basic structure of the system has to be changed. First of all, we have to get rid of the profit in the insurance industry and get rid of the thousands of insurers we have. All you need is one insurer. That's the lessons from most other countries. There's no advantage to having multiple insurers. Second, you've got to put a firm cap on the growth in overall healthcare expenditures, and you have to be willing to actively restrain price increases in healthcare. The market will not work to do that. That's one thing we've learned.
We went over that, but yeah, you can't shop around when you're sick.
Yeah. That's right. So we have to change the fundamental model. And you know, if we could get there incrementally, I'd actually be much happier because it would be a lot easier. But you can't get there from here. So
I'm glad at least talking about it because of Obamacare. I'm sitting here calling it Obamacare too, but I'm not sure how much of a step forward it really is because the man's lied about everything else, so I just don't really trust it. But
I mean the business about not having to change your insurance was not, you know, so I guess somebody told him he had to say that because that test is one of the biggest fears people have. People are afraid of change. And they're not very well educated about the alternatives, partially because the media has refused to seriously discuss the solution I'm proposing, which is a Medicare for all type of system. I mean, you couldn't get in front of a camera during the lead up to the Affordable Care Act because the Republicans didn't want you to discuss it because they don't have any effective comeback to it. And the Democrats were scared to death that it would undermine support for the ACA, which they thought was the only thing they could feasibly get through the Congress. So it was essentially a blackout on discussion. That's a shame because...
Well, again, too, I think regardless of party, they're just... The mass media is not going to go against Big Pharma. I mean, that's their principal advertiser.
Well, that's right. That's right. And it's a shame because... And I also fault not only the media, but my own academic colleagues, because they were afraid to speak up also. And they still are. They're still afraid to criticize the ACA because, I mean, who knows why? They may not have much courage to begin with, but they're also afraid of losing their grants and, you know, not being invited to the garden parties and all that stuff.
Yeah, people just start, politics is scary for most people who have real jobs. They don't want to get, it's like going into the mud to play, you know.
Yeah, and it's risky, it's dangerous, because people are retaliated against.
So the solution, one, that you're advocating is something like Medicare for all. Great. I don't know how we get that implemented. Is there maybe a chance we could go state by state and do something like that?
Yeah, that's what we're working on here in Maine. Vermont has already gone down that path. I heard Governor Peter Shumlin just 2 days ago in Boston talk about what's going on in Vermont, where they've passed a law saying we're going to move toward a nonprofit, single, universal system in Vermont. And we're trying to do the same thing here in Maine. We have a bill in the legislature that will be heard this coming year. It will almost certainly, it may pass the legislature, it may not. Even if it does, it'll certainly be vetoed by our Tea Party governor. And even if it becomes law, the insurance companies will take it to public referendum to try to get it repealed. So we feel here in Maine that sooner or later we're going to end up in a referendum on this issue.
Do you know the name of that bill?
It's called LD 1345 in the Maine legislature.
LD 1345.
Right. And we are, our organization, Maine All Care, is devoted to public education. We think it's critical that the public understand the real issues and the truth about this. So we're going around the state just basically doing grassroots organizing to try to inform the public and to immunize them against the scare tactics that will certainly be used if this concept that I'm advocating ever gets close to being reality. So it's an uphill fight for sure. I mean, we're fighting, it's a real David versus Goliath fight. But we think in a state like Maine, which is small, which is rural, which has a strong sense of community and a strong sense of fairness among the people here in Maine, we think it's doable.
I think Maine's the only state with clean election laws. Well, it was one of two or something. But
well, that's right. That's right. And they're being weakened now by the Republicans, but we're fighting back on that front too. So I think that the Canadian system started in one province, in Saskatchewan, in 1962. And there was a hell of a political fight. The doctors went on strike for 23 days in Saskatchewan. And they just hung tough, and they had a provincial prime minister, Tommy Douglas, who was just absolutely determined to do this. And he pulled it off. And once it was shown to work so well in Saskatchewan, it spread to the entire country within 10 years. And that's what I think is the most likely scenario in the United States.
Yeah, I think you have to show them it works.
Yeah.
You mentioned your Tea Party governor. I call that whole generation, that next generation of Tea Party people, the Teocons, because the original Tea Party was an anti-war party, and now it's nothing of the sort. They completely hijacked that. It's sort of like Occupy Wall Street. It started off as anti-bailouts and ended up just becoming a directionless mob.
But I think the Occupy people and the Tea Partiers actually have a lot in common. I just think the Tea Party, and I think they have a right to be mad. They're just wrong. They're mad at the wrong people. They shouldn't be mad at the government. You know, the government is pretty much a wussy. They ought to be having their anger directed at the corporations that are taking over our democracy.
Well, it's the combination of the two, because the corporations can't implement what they do without the force of government. And so it's the relationship between business and state that has to be severed. I mean, corporations are good. I know a lot of people are anti-corporate, but capitalism is good, and corporations do provide things. We're talking on computers and Skype and all that.
Ryan, you're absolutely right, but capitalism run amok is no good.
Right.
That's what's happening.
State assistance is when it goes crazy.
And the state is afraid to put the constraints around them that is necessary in a civilized society.
Right.
You can't let them do whatever they want to until they've wrung all of the wealth out of the rest of the country. And that's what's going on here. No, I agree with you. I ran a for-profit investor-owned company for 15 years. I'm not a socialist by a long shot, but I think you have to put constraints around capitalism, because it becomes very destructive unless you're willing to do that.
I think the argument is that they can't do whatever they want without the state, because they need state protectionist regulations and state enforcement to get the cartels and to make it like that. Otherwise, they compete with each other. And so it's all of them, it's basically a rent-a-government. They're all out there bribing and lobbying to get the state to give them favoritism.
Right.
It's corporate welfare. I mean, we see that over and over again with Lockheed Martin and the rest of them. It's like 90% of their business is from government.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we have speed limits, because you can't let people drive as fast as they want to. It's too dangerous to everybody else. And the same, I think, is true with the kind of corporatism we're seeing in the U.S. at the present time. I mean, we just have to put some speed laws in so that they can't become too destructive to too many people.
Well, I'm excited about this movement in Vermont and Maine, and I think we need to get people who, you don't have to live in those states to support this, because if we can get either one of them on this path, and once it starts working in one area, we might have the scenario like you described from Saskatchewan and Canada.
Right. And I think that the AC is actually going to help accelerate our movement, because one of the problems with healthcare is that many, many people never encounter the healthcare system unless they have an accident, until they get older. Mm-hmm. And the AC is going to require young people to deal with the healthcare system through the mandated coverage. They're going to be forced to interact with the healthcare system, where before the AC, they may just have been able to get away with ignoring it. They can no longer do that. So a lot more people are going to become engaged with the system and begin to figure out how fouled up it really is.
That's a lot of people I know. They don't have health insurance because it costs too much.
Right.
And they're just rolling the dice. They go, well, I hope I don't get sick or get in a car accident or anything, because I can't pay for it. But they're broke anyway if they have to pay for it. Because you get nickel-fired to death by everything else.
Yeah, but then you have to go into bankruptcy, and then you have that to hassle with. And it's all unnecessary. That's the point. Other countries have systems that get better results than we do, that cover everybody, that are much more popular with the politicians and the public than ours is. And, by the way, they cost about half as much.
Yeah, what blows my mind is it's all around us, and there it is. It's not a hypothetical thing, and people are still resistant to it.
Yeah, well, I I'm very pleased you're doing this show because you're doing a real service, I think.
Well, hopefully I can have Stephen Brill on also to get into sort of some specific examples of the things we were talking about today. And I appreciate your time. I'm running up. Well, we got a little bit of time left, but I think that what we really have to stress is how the cost of procedures are too high, and the reasons why market forces are sort of flipped upside down. And then one thing I was a little afraid of is if the Affordable Care Act is a disaster, because in my opinion it's just a step sideways, that it's going to be hard to get the public to talk about the issue again. So, like, we want to change healthcare. They go, oh, well, last time we did that, I ended up just having to pay more money for insurance. And it might be harmful in that sense.
Well, yes, but that's why I think it's more likely to happen at the state level than at the national level. Because I think this is an issue, you know, particularly the backlash that's developing because the websites don't work very well, is creating a lot of political pain all the way around. You know, the Republicans tried to shut down the government. That didn't work out too well for them. The Democrats are trying to implement it. They're getting tarred with that because the websites aren't working due to the complexity of the law. And they're not going to be anxious to revisit this issue anytime soon. There's just too much political pain involved.
Yeah, I think part of that too was the overall budget, because last year we had this whole debt ceiling crisis thing too, and it was not about Obamacare, and they nearly did the same thing. But the thing is, they're all hypocrites, both parties, because they all approve for all the stuff that's in the budget, and they overspend by so. I mean, I don't know what the point of having a ceiling is when they just ignore it all the time, but they've spent all these trillions of dollars in wars and financing mercenaries in Syria and all this other worthless stuff, slaughtering people all over the world and all this money. And then they don't want to spend money on health to help people. But they approved the whole thing. And so they say, well, we can't pay our debt, so unless we just, you know, use loan number two to pay loan number one sort of thing. That eventually has to be addressed, because you can't just perpetually raise the debt ceiling.
Well, you know, they've done a couple of things. When I was working on the Hill in the 1970s, they created the budget committees and the Federal Budget Act as a way of sort of trying to constrain overall costs. And the debt ceiling was added on top of that. I agree with you. I don't think it's necessary. I think they ought to just, you know, stick to a budget, but they apparently don't have the discipline to be able to do that. So. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I think it's a very dangerous time.
And well, that would take a long time to go over the economic problems of it all, but I'm more interested in your expertise as an MD on the medical side for this, too.
Right.
Yeah, well, good luck in Maine. You're in Maine, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, yeah, so you'll be working on that head-on then.
Oh, yeah, we're working on it all the time.
Well, everybody, LD1345, look that up, Google it, or use your favorite search engine. And let's get behind this. I think people saw that you do matter. If you look at how the administration wanted to bomb Syria, and enough people called, I think it was over 1,000 to 1 in opposition to it, and they didn't do it. Didn't even get to Congress because they knew they were going to shoot it down anyway. So if you get on the phone and you complain about this and you don't get suckered into this sort of BS debate about socialism and Obamianism and all that, and you really stick to the issues and say, listen, I want affordable health care, fix it, then we can get this ball rolling. But right now, Congress is scared to talk about it.
Yeah, and Ryan, I think that's absolutely right. People have to be willing to make this a voting issue.
Yes.
They have to pay attention. They have to insist that their representatives vote the right way on this. And if they don't, get them out of office. That's what has to happen. That's the only way to combat the big money in politics.
Absolutely. And there's just too much apathy. People who think that voting doesn't matter and blah, blah, blah. But that's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's right.
You've got to vote, and you've got to be active. And I don't mean just walking around in the park banging drums and stuff. You actually have to go inside the buildings, and you don't have to lobby with money. You can go in and lobby with ideas. I've done it. You go and talk to your representative or the legislative assistants or whoever they'll feed you, and nag them about it constantly. Because if you don't do that, they have no incentive to change it other than, you know, losing their career, because that's all they care about, unfortunately.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Be supporting this bill now. I know the number. I found out something that's going on in Maine. I didn't know about Vermont even, so thank you for educating us all on that.
Well, a pleasure. Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Be sure to bookmark ANC Report. Catch all the podcasts here. And of course, your generous donations are always welcome. That's what keeps these programs afloat. Thank you.